Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It's February 12th, 2020. And this is Radio Free Nintendo episode 664, I believe.
As if only it were February.
Yeah, I know. Oh, that's in February? Fuck. March 12th, 2020.
Here we are. Yep.
Look, it's been kind of a confusing day. I probably need to go into too much detail. I would imagine most people listening are aware. If you weren't, there's probably a Wikipedia article about it by the time you listen to this. You'll figure it out. If you look at the right date, again, March 12th, 2020, we'll probably have to talk about that a little bit later on, but we just kind of want to get into the show. I'm joined today by the returning Mr. John Lindemann.
It's great to be back, James.
Welcome back, John. Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
Hello, hello.
And Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
So, gentlemen, we have kind of a light new business load today, but that's okay. We'll see if we can actually keep some semblance of schedule. But, John, since you are our returning panelist, I don't know what the word here is, co-host.
Just couldn't bring yourself to describe him as returning hero or anything.
Well, that's not
just like,
it's okay. He'll get used to it. One day he'll say, you know, conquering hero or something like that. I don't know.
John, so knowing you don't listen to the show, how do you think we played you off last week?
Respectfully.
No.
I would say, these are the words that I would use to describe likely the way you treated me last week. With reverence.
Nope.
Respectful.
Absolutely not.
Likely, tasteful.
Very not true.
Thankful.
I did express some joy at the outcome, but no, I wouldn't call it thankful. Would you like one guess at where our excuse for where you were was?
Jesus, I don't even know. In the tub somewhere? I don't know.
Well, actually, you are remarkably close, but it was, you had been in the tub, but as a consequence of an event that transpired, you were no longer able to attend the show. Would you like to guess what transpired during a tub time incident that no longer allowed you to participate in Radio Free Nintendo?
What, I dropped my Switch in the tub or something?
You dropped your car battery powered Switch in the tub. Yes.
Okay, all right. Okay. But you know what? You know what? So I was on business travel last week because I'm so important. However, I will say, you know what? What bothers me the most is when I get checked into a hotel that only has a shower and does not have a tub. It really bothers me. That is one of the things when I am on the road, I look forward to tub time because hotel rooms have luxurious tubs typically. So I am a tub connoisseur. And it bothers me when I get checked in and a hotel room only has a shower. That's my rant.
So, good news on that, John. You just named the episode, which I appreciate.
fair enough.
So, having recently gone on business travel myself and only having a shower that I would describe as purpose-built for orgies...
Whoa. Okay, you're saying that's not going to be the episode title?
No, because Neil would Guillaume would refuse to publish the episode, and if he did, Neil would call me on my personal phone and ask what the fuck is wrong with me.
I don't think Guillaume is as much of a Puritan as you make him out to be.
I'm
not sure if anyone is really paying attention to what we're doing anymore.
Well, I mean, there's going to be an article on the front page. They'll notice that.
Yeah, this is true.
I mean, it's going to be the top site image, and it's going to say Tub Time Orgies, and they're going to go, nope. Absolutely not. So no, I say that because it was like 10 feet long by like 5 feet wide.
I had actually a fairly large shower as well. It was larger than probably it needed to be. So I wouldn't say it's quote unquote purpose built for orgies, however. people are very creative and they can do whatever they want.
It's kind of a phrase that you utter pretty seldomly, right?
It's a solemn phrase. My guess is it's about the size of a tub. My guess is hotels have been taking tubs out during remodels and replacing them with shower stalls because they're easier to clean.
Yeah, yeah.
And they use less water, which saves the hotel money.
It's a disturbing trend.
Because, I mean, it was about the size of a big tub, but it wasn't.
I mean, you know, and the thing is, I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with it if it wasn't for the fact that tubs are my bread and butter.
I don't even want to think about the consequences of that statement. Remember, send in your ideas for episode 666 to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. This is probably one of them.
Yep.
All right. So we're gonna let John transition to a different topic for the love of God.
Cool. All right. So my new business. Ori and the Will of the Wisps came out this week, and so I played a little bit of that. If you all recall, I actually played through Ori and the Blind Forest on Switch probably maybe 3 months ago, a little while back.
About.
Yeah. And so, yeah, played through that whole thing. So that game was fresh in my mind, so it kind of gave me a good place to start with Ori and the Will of the Wisps. Ori and the Will of the Wisps doesn't really stray that far from the original formula, so if you liked the first game, you'll like this game. I've only played into it a little bit. I mean, it just released, I think it released yesterday. So I only got to play, I've played maybe about maybe the first half hour of it, not too long into it. Just kind of went through the intro. And the way that at the end of Ori and the Blind Forest, of course, and this isn't really a spoiler because you encounter this enemy right at the start of the game, but of course the main boss in that game, or the big bad, is the owl that you fight. And at the end of the game, you come in, you get the egg from this owl, and at the start of Ori and the Will of the Wisps, that egg hatches. So, start of the game, Ori and this owl are palling around, and of course they get separated, hijinks ensue, and that's where you start. You start off in a new forest that is in the middle of a storm, and that's kind of where the story starts. And in terms of gameplay, it plays exactly the same, pretty much. Small difference in the weapons that you can wield. I think you start this one off, your weapon all the way through the first game was like a spark. It kind of flew out and it got more powerful as you went along, and it, you know, had more of a range and stuff like that. But this one, you start off with kind of the first thing you wield is a torch, but that's just kind of a temporary weapon, that eventually exhausts itself. And then the first real weapon that you get is this kind of energy sword. So that's just a little bit different, plays a little bit differently, but I mean, really, it's just, since Ori moves exactly the same, it's just kind of like, it's the same as the first game, except just a kind of a different weapon. One of the main changes that they made is they did get rid of the semi-goofy save system, where you would use one of your kind of, I believe, kind of the equivalent of magic orbs, or that you have to go through if you use one of your special powers. You used to use one of those, and you would place a kind of a spawn point, like a save point, on the ground. And that was fine. It worked okay, but occasionally what would happen, probably more than occasionally, is that you would forget. You would start to dig down into some new area and explore some new area, not even realizing that if you actually died, which can happen sometimes if you come across something that just kills you outright in an area that you've never been in, you would go all the way back to your last save point, which sometimes was ludicrously far back because you just hadn't saved in a while. You hadn't actually officially saved. And because in the first game, you could drop a save point, or you could go to a shrine. And in some areas, there's maybe one shrine for the entire large area. So you could kind of screw yourself a little bit by forgetting to drop a save point, and then you're like, oh man, I'm all the way back here now. So that's been avoided. You can still save at shrines, but you no longer drop the little save points. I think the game seems to save itself at certain points when you pick up certain items. So you're never too far back because you're always chasing the next item. So that's a little bit better now. Makes things a little bit more convenient to play through. But yeah, I mean, the game looks beautiful. The art style is the same. Music is just as good as the last game. I doubt that they've changed. I mean, like there were a few complaints about how it's sometimes hard to determine what can hurt you and what can't based on like the way it looks against the background. They haven't really done much with that because, like I said, the art style is exactly the same. But Guillaume will be happy, or maybe, I don't know, disappointed to see that it's not as depressing. It doesn't start out on such a depressing note as the first game does. So yeah, the beginning isn't death so much as just, you know, separation, and people are sad because they can't find their loved one, sort of thing. So
And is there some woman vocalizing in the soundtrack?
Probably. I mean, I'm kind of normalized. I've become normalized, you know, kind of immune to it. But
right.
Yeah,
I just need to develop a resistance to it.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think, but I don't think the theme song is as weepy as the first one.
Okay.
So
hopefully it will. Have they mentioned at all if it's coming to Switch?
They have not. I don't believe that's in the cards right now, but I'm sure it will be.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft still spent money on this. They're not going to talk about other versions for a while.
Yep.
Sure.
Yep. But right now, if you have Game Pass, it's free on Game Pass, just like every other Microsoft game. So, but it's good. I mean, if you're in the mood for like a Metroidvania sort of platformer, I mean, it's probably a little bit more streamlined to play than the first one. And you're not really missing anything by not playing the first game. It's not like the first game had some crazy plot or you know, its plot was pretty simple. So you're not really missing anything. So yeah, so I'll be playing through that for the next couple of weeks. The other thing that I've been playing is Doom, the original 1993 Doom. This is the version of Doom that Bethesda re-released, probably to coincide with the Doom reboot release, I think. I can't recall the timeline of when these were released, but I remember they all came out at the same time, and you can get them on Switch as well.
Yeah, they slashed the prices on these just recently because of obviously Doom Eternal coming up and almost giving them away. Was it $150 for Doom or Doom 2 in the States? A little less than that in pounds, obviously. And then Doom 3 was a little more expensive, but still very cheap. I got Doom 2 for the Switch. Mm-hmm. I've dabbled with it a little bit. First time, really. I mean, I've seen people playing it down the years and, kind of fiddled around with it temporarily, but not really, played any of the classic Doom games. So, yeah, it's just kind of interesting to see how it was.
Yeah, because, I mean, I played Doom when it first came out. I loved it. And to me, the game still holds up. It's actually refreshing to play a first-person shooter without a whole ton of mechanics layered on top of it. Like, you just look... So this game is, how old at this point? More than 25 years old? 2013? Yeah, I mean, it's like 27 years old at this point? And I mean, it's just nice that, I mean, you can't jump, you can't sprint, you can't throw a grenade, you don't have a sniper rifle, it's just, you just see just how these things evolve to where now if you play a first-person shooter, you have 14 different things that you can do in any one time. Whereas this, it's fast, you go around, you shoot things, and that's it. So,
yeah, that's kind of the biggest thing for me to playing Doom 2, which does have sprint, so it's faster. But yeah, it's very fast. And the thing is, because there isn't really any kind of verticality in the aiming, obviously, you're in a 3D space, but the way you aim, like an enemy could be on like a higher perch, but you're going to hit it if you're aiming correctly on the horizontal axis. So it just makes it, very fast and, kind of frantic. And it's because of that, it's a little bit more like a 2D run and gun in 3D, if you know what I mean, than when you do have to worry about like fine tuning the aiming along kind of both axes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is kind of annoying not being able to look up or down. That kind of drives me crazy sometimes. Just because they do have a lot of puzzles that play with height, right? So maybe you can't, you might come out into an area where you have to kind of walk out onto a cliff or walk out into the middle of an open space and there's like something below you to the right, but you kind of can't see it unless you go way to the other side of the room and look around and look like, move yourself to a spot where you just happen to be able to see down there because you have the broader view. But I mean, they do a lot of cool stuff with, light and dark. You'll go into dark areas and you hear the monsters, but you don't know where they are until they're right on top of you. They do a lot of cool stuff, like almost like jump scare kind of stuff. I mean, that game was like, I think that game is well designed from the standpoint of just being ahead of its time and really There's just a lot of stuff in there where they didn't have a lot to work with, but they made a lot. They did a lot with it. So yeah, it's really fun. I mean, I got through the first, and it also makes me laugh because I remember when this came out. It came out episodically, and there's four different chapters, and I remember this is back when it was released by Apogee Software, I think, if I remember correctly. And
yes, it would have been.
Yeah, yeah, and you bought episode one, and then they slowly released episode 2, 3, and 4, and so they're all in this collection. All the DLC is in this collection, but it's just I just remember that. I remember, you know, getting this stuff on like 3.5-inch discs. And playing it on my PC, it's just really funny.
DLC is an interesting phrase to use to describe. You mean MLC, where you mail?
Yes, exactly.
MC, what would you call it? Mail MOC, mail order content.
Yeah, I mean, back then things in the PC, the PC industry was very, very different, to say the least. Because I mean, I don't even think that Doom was necessarily. It wasn't even really on store shelves at that time.
You could buy like a demo for $1.
Yeah.
And you would go in a little bit and then you would hit a door and it'd be like, do you want to see more blood?
Yeah.
Send $14.99 or check or cash to this address and you will be mailed more blood.
Like there was no real, there was no, you know, downloaded versions of games at that time. Like you had to get it on disc somehow.
I mean, by that time, they might have, I was on the internet at that point, so maybe there was some degree of that,
yeah,
but it was...
I think I just got on the internet at the back end of 93, but I mean, the speeds that
it was dire.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah.
I know you're talking about games on floppies, but still, I mean, God knows how long that would have taken.
I had a 14.4 modem. That's 14.4K. Yeah, that means it's about 10 seconds to download a meg.
That was our first one, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's interesting. But yeah, so there's four chapters in this one. And so I'm on chapter 2. I beat the first chapter, which is Knee Deep in the Dead. And then this one, I forget what the second one is called, but yeah. No, it's cool.
And the thing is, I think they did clean up these versions a bit, mm-hmm. you know, before they got heavily discounted in the run up to Doom Eternal in terms of, you know, kind of like frame rate issues, like music timing issues, other sound things. I mean, to be fair, I think there was more issues when they first came out, and there was the whole BethesdaNet thing and all that.
Yep,
they cleaned those up pretty quickly, but then they sort of came back and fixed some of the like somewhat lesser but still outstanding issues. Playing it now, it seems. Yeah, really smooth. Obviously, I can't speak to the fidelity of it relative to playing it back in the day, but nothing to complain about. Just playing it kind of fresh now.
Yeah, the only thing that I've seen performance wise is what you can tell it's doing is it loads the entire game in. So when you start a new area, it's like sometimes it's kind of choppy a little bit because you can tell it's just like loading it all in so it can play it at 60 frames. So, but once the whole thing loads in, it's really, really quick. So,
I distinctly remember, I had some of the Apogee games as a kid, but I distinctly remember like Epic and some of their contemporaries doing the same, like, hey, here's a little bit of game we're going to give you. The idea that we've now come full circle and this game is probably available completely. And it's coming out basically the same time as Doom Eternal,
mm-hmm.
which, like, that franchise is bizarre to think about at this point. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still, I kind of love it, though, because I would classify it as a mainstream game, but I just feel like it's never really... I don't know. Those games really sold out to me, if that sounds, if that makes any sense. Like,
Doom 3 is probably the closest.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's kept, when it really made the transition to 3D, which I guess was Doom 3.
Mm-hmm.
because Doom 2 is still using what's the term they use for how those games are drawn? I'm blanking on it now. Where it's actually drawing like a weird like anyway, it's not real 3D, obviously.
Yeah, it's like I was saying about the aiming. That's how it manifests in gameplay. And if having not played Doom to any significant degree back in the day, it mostly reminds me of a screensaver on my early Windows.
It does.
Going through the maze, yeah.
That's probably like the first, but that series has basically kept its ethos, which weirdly seems to work for that series better than some of its contemporaries. Obviously there are other id Soft games that did not make the cut, I guess would be a way of saying it. But generally speaking, their stuff kept going. Like, you know, Doom, Wolfenstein, Quake, Rage.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all their games kind of fall, well, with the exception of Commander Keen, all kind of feel in the same general way, for lack of a better word. So it kind of works in a weird sort of way. And I think by keeping the same people around, generally speaking, they were able to keep that going. Even after ZeniMax came in and bought them, it still seems like it's the same sort of style.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come off as weird and dated and hokey and cheesy.
Yeah.
Probably in part because they never put a character in the lead. I mean, BJ Blazkowicz is, but he's basically nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. They never tried. I guess when I say it never sold out, I feel like they never tried to, like, build a universe around it or anything. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, yeah.
And they've maybe done that with the last two games a little bit, but still not a whole lot. Like, you're still kind of like this, like, you know, this anonymous,
it's,
you know,
yeah, I mean,
Marine.
It's still basically about the gameplay. Like,
yeah.
the story and stuff is all just there as a window dressing for what is ultimately, this is a really fast shooting game with lots of enemies and kill rooms and shit like that.
Yeah, like you're killing demons, and that's really about as deep as it gets.
Yeah, I think that the obvious parallel is the stuff that was coming out of 3D Realms, and they were much more focused on, you know, the presentation and the the presentation in the sense of, like, let's make this a thing.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they were more interested in kind of, like, the game engine more than just really hanging a whole kind of universe around it.
Yeah. I'll point out that it's 3D Realms made a pinball game called Balls of Steel back in 1997. And they did hire John St. John to say the name of the software.
Nice. Yeah.
Yep. It's great.
As one does.
As one of, and so 3D Realms actually was the Apogee ones. Id stuff was just Id, I think.
Yeah.
I think I was wrong earlier. So yeah, I'm pretty sure that they had a name before that, but I don't think they actually published anything worth remembering under that name. But yeah, now they are part of the ZeniMax engine. With about 20 other companies at this point.
Yeah.
But John Romero.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's actually, if you want to read a good book, you should read Masters of Doom. That's a really cool book.
Yeah,
it details the entire development of Doom and all the Doom games, and, you know, I mean, because this is basically just started by, like, you know, John Carmack and a bunch of people, like, just in Mesquite, Texas.
Yeah,
yeah, and it talks about going all the way through to, like, Ion Storm and all that kind of stuff. It's a really cool book, really, really good.
There's some wild people who worked on the Doom games.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like American McGee was involved in Doom 2.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. The chapters are called Knee Deep in the Dead, The Shores of Hell, Inferno, and Thy Flesh Consumed. So there you go.
I thought they were being real fancy.
Yep. Yeah. And it's interesting actually going through, like, since I've played into the second chapter, you can see that you can kind of tell the way it was developed, because you can see they added new enemies. They're trying a little bit different things. Like in the second level, in the second chapter, you know, you can teleport. And you can just see that they said, okay, well, for this chapter, we did this, this, and this. And for this chapter, we're going to add on this stuff. So it's cool. Very cool, cool. Game.
Guillaume.
Yeah?
What you up to?
So last week, I've gotten an erratum. I mentioned that Trials of Mana is like 50 hours long. That's not nearly the truth. It's about 20-25. I'm almost at the end, so.
I mean, you just round it up. It's fine.
I think I confused it with a different RPG that I'm also playing.
But that's still, I mean, 20-25 is decent length for a 16-bit.
Absolutely, RPG. Yeah. But still, it's not 50, which would have been
I did that sounded long for a game of that of its day on a cartridge system, but I guess it depends, you know, how much they wanted to drag it out.
Yeah, well, even as I was playing it, I thought, well, it's possible because they do make you replay certain areas and things like that. Like you go through every area in the world, and then you have to revisit all those areas and kill new bosses. So I thought, well, I don't know. It's possible. But yeah, it's nowhere near 50. The other thing that I've been playing is a little bit more of is Murder by Numbers. So I've played that enough, not enough to give the final word on if the story goes, you know, ends up on a good note or anything like that. Like, I can't tell you if it stays the course, if it stays good the whole time. I'm just like in the middle of chapter 2 of 4. But I've played it enough to say that it's a weird game. Like, it is. I've seen a lot of people say, like, oh, it's Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney, and Picross. Like, it's how can a game that is so like a convergence of two things that I like exist? Like, it's like they made this game just for me. And indeed, like that's what it is. But it is strange to be playing this kind of visual novel where you interact with characters and you're playing as her name is Honor. And she's like, you know, the actress that I mentioned. So you interact with the characters as her, and then like you've got the flying sidekick, the computer, who, like, the whole idea why you're playing Picross is that its memory banks are damaged, and so it has to scan the area, scan objects, and kind of rebuild its database and identify objects and scan crime scenes, and so that's why you do Picross. It can be a little bit unsatisfying if what you want to do is just go through the story as fast as you can, and then like the Picross gets in the way of that. Or if you want to do Picross, the story gets in the way of you doing more puzzles. So I don't know. I feel like it's a strange rhythm. It's not like neither of those parts are bad. It's just, I don't know. I'm still not used to this strange, you know, off and on Picross and
How's it compare in that rhythm sense to like a Layton game, you know, where you do, you know, it's kind of a visual novel adventure type thing punctuated by puzzles, but it's just different kinds of puzzles.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about that. You're right. And I think personally, yeah, I guess it has the same kind of strength and weaknesses as a Layton game in that sense. Like, I don't think that I would be playing Layton games if they were just a string of puzzles without context. So I want that story, but at the same time, kind of tapping everywhere on the screen was annoying. And sometimes I would be looking forward to doing more puzzles, and so having to find the right people to speak to could get annoying. So yeah, I guess it's nothing that, yeah, Layton fans haven't dealt with already. I guess I'm not used to that anymore, and so it kind of feels weird to me. But yeah, it's an excellent game. It's pretty well written. It's I don't find it as funny anymore as I did at the beginning, but maybe that's because the story got a little bit more real. But when I say more real, I just mean like, oh yeah, okay, there are deaths and stuff, there are murders, and you have to solve them. You know, like, there are jokes, but there's also a lot of, holy crap, like, okay, how does this keep happening? Also, it's kind of weird. Like, clearly, as I said, the main character is an actress in the detective show. I've now learned that her dad was a cop or a detective, and I think that maybe she was lined up to become a cop herself before she decided to become an actress. So I'm not sure what's happening with that. But it's kind of funny, like right away, like in the first case, the whole reason why you're even investigating is because first a flying robot has come to you asking for your help to recover its memories, which is kind of weird. But also the situation is that your part just got canceled on the show, by the showrunner. And so then
Bastard.
And then, like, you go to your car, you can't find your keys, you come back, and then, oh, the showrunner has been murdered. And so the cops arrive, they confine you to the break room, you and everyone who was on set or who could be potentially a suspect. But you just decide to go through the vent and examine the murder scene yourself because the cop is not going fast enough to your taste. And I just find that, I don't know, I find that really funny because it's absolutely absurd, right? Like, someone please put this woman in jail. She just goes on murder scenes because in her estimation the cops are not doing the right thing and she's gonna solve this murder herself, damn it. Like, it's a really kind of flimsy premise in the first place, but I'm enjoying it so far. The more I think about it, the more absurd this is becoming, you know.
How tough are the puzzles?
It's really, that's another thing. I think that the difficulty of the Picross puzzles is pretty uneven, and I'm kind of breezing through most of them, but of course I'm at the beginning of the game, so I think that's pretty normal, but
they'll probably all be pretty routine for you, James, knowing you. I think you just bit of blood, you know.
Look, nobody ever protested when I said Picross 3D was pretty easy. It just is. It's not that hard of a game, and that just kind of bored me. I don't need your sass.
I'm just saying, I think 2D Picross, you're just going to look at it and go, what?
You think I'll just, with one button press, it will all be solved?
No, but I think you'll get through it pretty quickly.
Greg, you might see a Picross grid, but what James see is blondes, brunettes, redheads.
Yes, the Matrix. I believe, you know, from years of editing and participating in this podcast, I have a pretty good feel for James' gift for this sort of algorithmic process.
Well, I will say I'm a programmer
for a reason, damn it.
Exactly. It's not, I'm not taking the piss. It's a legitimate point. You're very good at this. The vast majority of people that are going to play this game are going to find Picross more challenging than you do. I have no reservations about making that statement.
Fair enough.
But I can say that I've played a few Picross games in my day. So I've been, you know, like I'm kind of automatic for a lot of them because they do... Most of them have had, like, you know, they give you the border to work with, which is kind of... from then, like, you can just, like, draw a big part of the picture pretty easily because it's just... They just basically tell you, right? Like, okay, so these... All this stuff on the left of the screen, you can just basically fill out for free. So they've been fairly easy. Some of them, I've been surprised. It kind of demanded that I deduct, you know, where things should go and where things couldn't be, in a way that I'm not used to and in a way that the game didn't really teach me. So, you know, like there's not 1,000 ways to solve a Picross grid, but like this was right. One that I was not super used, a trick that I was not super used to employing. So I was kind of surprised by that. But yeah, mostly it's been pretty easy. Of course, Karen is also playing. She's never played Picross before. She wasn't really interested in those puzzles. But the whole structure of this game, convinced her to give it a shot, and now she put in the work to, you know, understand basically how Picross works, and so she's been slowly learning and going through the game, and I think that she hasn't hit that puzzle that I just talked about. I don't know what's going to happen, but the thing is, you do get assist modes, or, you know, like an easy mode if you are not super used to Picross puzzles. So I've been playing without the assist. But if you do use the assist, like, it can tell you, like, okay, you just messed up here, and it just fills it up for you. Like, it corrects you as you go, which is a huge help, of course. Because then you're just not building on a mistake that you made early on.
Right.
So, yeah, so I think that anyone basically can play this game, all the skill levels. The only thing that might be different is if you play on harder modes, you get more points at the end of a Picross puzzle. And then if you get enough points, you get like an S rank for as a detective. And that just, all that means is that it unlocks standalone Picross puzzles, which you, if you solve all of them for a given chapter, it unlocks a memory in your flying computer companion.
As you do.
Yeah, so there's that. The final thing I want to say is that, unfortunately, also the... I don't know, like, the. I think that Nintendo... Maybe I'm just used to Jupiter and Nintendo kind of going to the extra mile to, most of the time, when they could do it, making sure that your Picross drawing actually looked like something.
Yeah.
Here, it's not always clear exactly how the grid that you just filled up translates into the then, like, the color picture that shows up on the screen and that is supposed to represent, like, a pen pot or, I don't know, like, the map of the vent ventilation system.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So it's like, it's a little bit, I guess not disappointing, but because I don't really care that much, but there's clearly not as much care into the aesthetic side of Picross. Like, you're not going to see a puzzle, like, you're not going to put the finishing touch and be like, oh, that's a puppy. That's great, you know? But anyway, overall, I'm enjoying it. I just wanted to throw those, not caveats, but those warnings out there, I guess.
Fair enough. All right. Well, that is going to do it for new business. When we come back, we're going to kind of do a little bit of some news. Maybe we'll do some new business. Some listener mail. We'll figure it out as we go. But you're going to be on this ride with us, so enjoy that. And we are back. This is the second segment. If you can't guess from the first segment being the one before it, you did not miss a segment in the middle. It's not listener mail, although we might do a little bit. Kind of want to talk about some of the news that's been happening. Obviously, the spread of the COVID-19 virus has kind of upended a bunch of stuff. You know, sports events are being canceled or played in front of empty arenas, which is really weird to watch. Schools are being shut down. People are being told to work remote. And events like E3
Don't forget TurboGrafx Mini's been delayed.
Oh, my God. You know, that thing has been, quote, coming for so long. I figured it had been out for months.
They just announced it way, way ahead of time, but it was finally meant to be coming out like in a week from when we recorded this. But
damn it!
No, you're 57, 58 games, whichever. Yeah, I think it's virtually the same across Japan and America, because it's kind of like half for American games, half for Japanese games, but there's tiny little differences. But yeah, if you wanted to finally play Sapphire because it's ridiculously expensive physically and you've never emulated it before, you're going to have to wait.
God damn it. There goes my plans for this time I'm trapped.
Yeah,
at home.
I could tell you had your heart set on it as soon as I brought it up.
Oh, like, I just figured I just missed it. I was like, I missed the TurboGrafx. I guess I didn't care that much after all. But now I care intensely. Thank you, Greg. and of course, events like E3 have been canceled. So E3 2020 will not be happening in LA. I think it was scheduled to go June 15th, sometime around there. John, as of this moment, WrestleMania is not postponed.
They remain doggedly committed to having WrestleMania.
There is no way WrestleMania is happening.
There's no way. No way. There's no way.
They're going to have it at the Performance Center. We're going to watch The Undertaker walk across Performance Center for 40 minutes.
Well, note that they haven't. They said that WrestleMania is still happening, not when or where it's happening.
Okay, you've got to, even if it's behind closed doors, you've got to do it just for the irony value of The Undertaker in a face mask.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. I mean, he's an old man. He needs to be
he's in the vulnerable group, surely.
Well, they're going to bring back Isaac Yankum DDS because he already have a mask, so it's perfect.
Oh, my God. I felt like we had to address it, and we're gonna. That's basically the news we have right now. So it's a little, I don't want to use the word convenient. That's the wrong word here. E3 was already kind of in a weird state.
Yeah, possibly falling apart at the seams without any further tearing on the part of mass gatherings being a profoundly sort of iffy idea.
Yeah. Sony had said they weren't going to participate. Presumably they were intending to unveil the PS5 at their own leisure and then sort of do its public showing at GDC.
Where is that?
Is there an S or not? The eternal question of a video games journalist. There is no S.
Wasn't it also true that the handheld or whatever it was that was written out as game.com was supposed to be spoken as just Gamecom. So
is an S. I'm wrong. I'm always wrong. No matter what, it's Schrodinger's gaming convention. No matter what you say is wrong. But yes, the game.com was the Tiger Electronics nightmare device.
But I don't think you meant to speak the dot aloud.
Don't say the dot.
It was written out that way.
So you know that because when you booted it up, it went Gamecom. And then the game booted. And if you're wondering, does James know that noise inherently because he once had one? The answer is stop asking questions. There's no way Gamescom happens. Gamescom is like a petri dish. Mm-hmm.
A lot of these events are typically go sort of somewhat infamous for people coming poorly on a fairly widespread scale. Obviously, it's just not.
I was surprised with
viruses that are already in the population. So it's not the same situation.
Right. I mean, PAX East is a particularly virulent event because it's right in the middle of cold and flu season in the Northern Hemisphere.
Now, I just listened to a Retronauts episode where I think that they mentioned that someone caught the flesh-eating bacteria from one of the beanbag chairs at PAX.
Yes.
I've sat on those.
I regret to inform you, Guillaume, that you are either patient zero or patient some number higher. Yeah. For a necrotic flesh-eating disease.
Perhaps
it's
just incredibly difficult to digest and it's been biding its time.
I have been losing weight, but anyway.
Hey, congratulations. PAX East is, it is of the viruses, of the virus circulating facilities. Its timing in the calendar is also particularly atrocious. This is just not, this is just the responsible thing to do. E3, I think, I'm not going to accuse anybody of doing anything for their own benefit here, but E3 was already kind of in a perilous situation. They had hired IM8Bit, of all people, to organize their influencer-friendly event, who then pulled out, presumably because they saw the writing on the wall, but also because they seemed thoroughly unqualified for the task at hand. I mean, I assume they were really just the front of a larger event planning organization because, like, their events experience is basically running art galleries, which means J&J Dream Factory has as much experience putting together events because we did telethons for a bunch of years.
Mm-hmm. We did.
What is 8-Bit?
I'm 8-Bit. Basically, they sell swag. They sell branded shit. I think they were the ones who made, they describe themselves as video game collectors, vinyl soundtracks, and more.
I see.
It's like, do you want to get the vinyl soundtrack of Ori and the Blind Forest or Rocket League? Do you want to get some...
Sure.
Yeah, do you want to get limited run of Sayonara Wild Hearts?
You would have loved E3, Guillaume. You're the real victim here, Guillaume.
What about a retro remake of the Mega Man X cartridge?
Well, that's too bad, because maybe I Am Bits Lost could have been Fangamer's gain. Really.
Yeah, I mean, they have a little bit more merch than Fangamer, but basically, yeah, that's it. That's what you're looking at. Like, that's the kind of organization this was. And yeah, they've done things like run art gallery events and stuff. But still, like, this seemed thoroughly outside their wheelhouse and was roundly mocked when it was announced. And rightly so, because it was like, oh shit, E3 is fucked. We didn't know at the time that E3 is fucked in a very different and much more serious way. But, you know, Microsoft's been out of E3 officially, even though they have their press conference and they have an event literally right next door for a few years now. Sony announced they were out this year. EA is out too, right? They've been out for a little bit. And Activision's been out for a while, for years and years and years. So yeah, the show was kind of imperiled anyway. There is open conversation about whether or not we think E3 comes back in 2021. I'm of the opinion it does, because I think they're going to take a mulligan on this one and try to put it back together. I don't know what you guys think.
You mean for 2021?
Yeah.
I'm sure they will. It's too big of a brand name to just dismiss it entirely.
Well, keep in mind, this is also how the ESA makes, like, the majority of their revenue.
Yeah.
Like, it's selling booths.
Yep. Sure it'll come back, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know what John means in terms of the cachet. You know, you think you could do something with that, even if it ends up being something markedly different.
Santa Monica Airport, let's go!
But you how, obviously every year is different this year. So you've got, you know, we're in the run up to PS5 and Xbox Series two. X. Sorry, yeah, I gotta keep these things strong.
Just call it two.
But, you know, to some extent one can only assume it'll be a case of, you know, how much not just the platform holders, but anybody else involved kind of feels that they're, you know, substitute endeavors that are going to be streamed and, you know, whatever else is done remotely, how well it substitutes and how much do we actually need, you know, the other components of it. It's not necessarily going to be fair to compare, you know, this particular year to previous years or subsequent ones in terms of like what your objectives are and how well you can achieve them. You know, just doing remote stuff, but I'm sure it will inform, you know, the decision of a lot of the major players in terms of how enthusiastically they would support the idea of it coming back or in what form. And then that's ultimately going to have a big, you know, influence on what does happen with the show, if anything.
Yeah. I feel like E3 is the Atari of game conferences, where it's like everybody probably has a certain fondness for E3, just like they do for Atari on some level. And even though it's long dead and shouldn't be brought back, it just keeps getting resurrected in the weirder ways. Exactly. So I think E3 is going to kind of be like that. Like, people are just going to not let it die. The ESA will not let it die. There's no way.
Yeah, I think I think in a weird way, again, this is one of those, like, I'm going to say something that might sound incredibly insensitive, but I don't mean it that way. I think in a weird way, this worked out well for them, because this year, the show looked like it was headed for a catastrophe. Like, it looked bad.
The face-saving sense, you think. You can rightly attribute the fact that you called off the show because of, you know, very real concerns that are affecting all sorts of events that, you know, are completely, you know, would have gone off without a hitch, without, you know, were there not these sort of extenuated circumstances, when in fact, you know, this was a lot on much shakier ground. But, you know, I mean, it should have been a really big year when you've got new consoles. Those should be the biggest years, you know, the most hype and the most sort of mainstream media interest in an E3 is going to be when, you know, especially, you know, two of the, you know, the big hardware players have got, Sony weren't going to be there, you know, directly and all that, but Microsoft, I think, we're going to go in some capacity. And then, you know, you've always got the one versus the other factor. So it still would have ginned up a lot of interest, but whether the show would have, you know, done, you know, actually, from the logistical point of view, gone off well and, you know, achieved what it's supposed to achieve is a completely separate question.
Right. I mean, so there was the real risk that, besides the now real risk, there was the real risk that, you know, you walked into E3 2020 and it just felt empty. And that is a dire, dire situation because it makes the entire industry look weak. Keep in mind, ESA is the trade industry. These companies are the company that runs E3, like Nintendo, Sony, Microsoft, Activision, Electronic Arts. The big players are the ESA, and they run the show. So Sony is pulling out of a conference. Sony pulled out of a conference, of which they are in a not immaterial way, the ones running, or rather a. The ones running it are a proxy for their will.
Yeah. It's like the commissioner for the owners in a sports league.
Yeah. Yeah. Like when the commissioner rules against an owner, it's kind of a big deal. But, you know, it was weird. And Sony saying, you know, we're not going to be E3. Like that was a really strange feeling. And last year, weren't they like really a reduced role last year too?
Well, it was the oddness of like, well, we've got like an event in a church somewhere or something.
Yeah.
The precise circumstances. Yeah. I wasn't desperately interested in Sony's presentation there. But yeah, it's, they've been drifting away from, you know, wrapping their arms around that event. And of course, when you've got the issue of showcasing a console, a new console, new platform before it's going to go on sale, you know, over the sort of holiday period later that year. It's so important that I get the fact they just want to like completely control it. Just take it out of any kind of venue that they have less than total control over. So, I mean, I do understand that, even though, like I said, it's in some ways it should be, you know, what E3 is best at is actually like putting a megaphone in front of these sorts of like really big moments in the industry.
Yeah, and of course the risk is that E3 is a situation where everyone has a megaphone and they're all screaming at as loud as they can at the same time. And so maybe your megaphone, I mean, you can literally see the metaphorical megaphone up until last year where Sony wasn't on the floor, by standing in the exact spot between Sony and Nintendo's booths, because they were historically Sony Online Entertainment was in the front, and then right behind them was Sony Computer Entertainment, Online Entertainment being like Star Wars Online and whatever. That's a weird pull. But EverQuest.
Sure.
Yeah. Before they sold it and stuff like that. And then it was Capcom parallel to them, and then behind Capcom was Nintendo, and then Capcom moved at some point. But if you stood at a spot where you could see into Sony's booth and see into Nintendo's, you could actually hear the sound of like the two people essentially pushing PR as loud as they can. Conversely, if you went to the other hall where the third parties and Microsoft were segregated away from everyone for their safety, the only thing you could hear was noise, just loud noise, just constant sound. But yeah, I mean, the show was going to feel very empty. And so they had done this whole thing about trying to rebrand it in a way that sounded very PAX-y, where they're like, it's going to be about the experiences. It's going to have lots of influencers. And I want to give them a little bit of credit here, because I was busting on them hard for this, just making fun of them nonstop. They put out an email address when they announced this and said, like, hey, if you've got some advice on how to handle things you'd like to see at E3, let us know. So I wrote this. I don't even want to use a missive because that sounds.
Yeah, well, this did just think, you know, the risk of stating the obvious after the whole blowing everyone's personal data thing.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so
it's also asking the internet anything like this is a bad idea in general.
Yeah, you know you're going to take your lumps on it. Yeah. But at the same time, it's what we would say over here is a bit of a cheek. To ask such things after you've just thrown up all over yourselves and everybody else with the way you handled the personal data.
No, mostly everybody else. And their statement actually didn't address the personal data very much. They basically just said, we're not going to store this stuff next to the website. I'm like, yeah, no shit. That doesn't own it. Own your fail. Own it. But the email I wrote them, hell, I'll just read it. I've attended 5 E3s in my career, and admittedly, the terms used in today's announcement worry me that E3 is going to feel more like a PAX than an E3. As someone who's there to do a job, that's disconcerting. Getting around the show to see and engage new games, provide coverage, and seek answers to questions is physically demanding. With limited time and stamina available, I can't afford to lose time trying to contend with bad traffic flow and long lines for, and I use their quote, experiences. Recommendation is simple, but understandably difficult to create. To execute, create a flow that allows for the movement through the show, minimizing choke points, and create policies that compel exhibitors to push crowds into their spaces rather than the aisles around it. Likewise, encourage exhibitors to consider the different groups attending E3 into the design of their booth. The easier it is for members of the press to get to engage with its content, the more likely that smaller products also get seen and reported on. I'm not suggesting refraining from creating, again, a festival-like atmosphere, which is their words, in the booth, but maintaining access to what we're here to see, the games, should be paramount. End of the email. This is not an email I expected a response to. I was mostly just making a point. I got a personalized response from someone who is actually on the ESA website, directing it to the person who was in charge of publisher relations with specific call-out points to that person. Saying like, hey, can you include this in our feedback information? Like, I was like, oh, okay, they're actually taking this shit seriously, and I was really surprised they did that. the show was
probably canceled. Your email was probably the only articulate email they'd ever received, so they felt they had to respond.
You should have told us. I would have sent an inarticulate email just to see if they responded to mine, but.
So the funny thing was I tweeted the screenshot of my email to them, and then I responded, I will now resume the millennial thing and dunk on the ESA. I look forward to seeing Fallout Boy on the I Am 8-Bit stage in South Hall. Unfortunately, we're not going to get any of that. We're not going to get any of these experiences. I mean, companies are going to do their digital events.
Obviously Nintendo...
You know, they were already going to do it.
Yeah, so, well, now it'll be the Treehouse Live moniker will be sort of more accurate, presumably. Like, they'll just have it, they'll have some sort of set actually built on site at the Treehouse for them.
In a Treehouse.
Oh, yes, they could go literal.
Full meta on it.
They could go literal. There's always that. I'm just hoping it's basically going to be like the Donkey Kong Country VHS. thing.
Why not the Star Fox one when there's a hostage situation involved?
Yeah, and the secret tech or the espionage about the tech.
It's rumbling.
Oh dear. Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how much it changes the character of that sort of stuff. Yeah, whether Nintendo uses it as an opportunity to change it a little bit, or whether they actually try and keep it as consistent as possible.
I think what you're going to see this call is going to be called the June Direct. I don't think they're going to try to do any kind of digital E3 branding, or even if the ESA wants to try to get all this stuff to happen around the same time, so they can try to wrap some kind of digital label around it. Nintendo's just going to call it what it is. I bet it's still a big deal. I bet they still have. Just keep in mind, most of their segments are pre-produced. You know, like their interviews and stuff. The person's not there. They are there for the Treehouse Live, but for the video segments, like, those are all, you know, I think back to the Goodfield team hanging out in a yarn shop. Like, yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah, that's true. Or the Star Fox Zero with the shrine and, you know, the, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's
plenty. Like, they could
plenty of that kind of stuff, but I guess it feels like they've been dialing that back a little bit as time's gone on.
But they can still do interviews and then just play them during the Treehouse Live. So maybe the gameplay segment is live. And to be honest, the person who's making the game doesn't even have to be there for those. Like, they can just Skype that person in, for lack of a better word. Like, if we get to June, and God, I hope this isn't the case. I hope by June things have turned around and we're good and international travel is fine again and everything's great. If there's still some trepidation, then yeah, I mean, they can do all of this remote. They can set up a studio in Japan and set up a studio in North America and do interviews that way or talk about the game as it's being played that way. It's a little clunky and it's going to look weird, but you know, it's fine. I bet they still do big, long streams that run for many hours because now they're really going to need something to watch. You know, it's content, and live content is king in all forms, regardless of the situation. On that point, I did want to say it's the whole situation sucks. I don't mean the entire situation around this epidemiological situation. But you know, I have looked at things as they've been canceled and just gone, shit, that's a real bummer. You know, E3 getting canceled was a bummer. I was curious to see if we were headed to some kind of glorious train wreck or if we were going to see like a faux PAX that just didn't work, because there's already three PAXes in North America alone. Four if you count PAX Dev, which I don't really. But there's already three PAXes. There's, can't remember the name of the event that's in the DC area that I always want to go to and just forget right around the start of the year. Like these events already happened. The need for the ESA to create a fourth one or a fifth one, depending on how you look at it, MAGFest, is unnecessary. And so it seemed ill-conceived, and it looked like it wasn't being run organically, like they were trying to manufacture a MAGFest or a PAX, and you can't do that. Those things evolved organically over time. You know, they just canceled the NCAA tournament. That's my favorite time of the year, and yeah, I was a little bummed about it. And I think that's okay. It's okay to be upset about, you know.
But are you bummed to be alive, James?
No, I'm not, John. I'm bummed to be talking to you.
What a weird accusation.
That's a different issue altogether. I don't think there's any reason to feel guilt for it, although I do. I think that's just kind of a natural response right now because this is so weird and bizarre. It sucks, and I'm bummed out about E3 being canceled. I really enjoy E3. Like, we've gotten emails in the past. People are like, why do you always talk about going to E3 being so bad? I'd love to go to E3. Well, you can now. Well, not this year. It's open to the public. But, you know, I touched on that email. It's a job. It is physically destructive to your body. I need at least... I am not right after E3 for 2 weeks. If I go, at a minimum, it takes me 2 weeks to get back into, like, I'm alive again. It takes a week just for the base level volume in your brain to turn down enough that normal conversation isn't understimulating. Because everything has gone nuts for 72 hours in your brain, and your brain is just scrambled. But even running even doing remote coverage for the site is crazy and exhausting. And, you know, it's 12 straight hours of like, who's got these screenshots? Just completely unnecessary levels of drama that materialize as a consequence of you're like right on the edge of like going after Carmine Red's brother, who's just helping us out for like, I need those pictures, man. And it's like, wait, he's just helping us out. Why am I getting stressed about this? It's fine. Everything's fine. But that's fun. Like, it's a fun thing to have the site and just go and just put content out there and get nuts for a little while. I'm bummed out about it. I'm bummed out about all this stuff. And of course, yeah, you know, there's perspective. I'm bummed out about the entire situation as it is. You know, it's awful. And we all just kind of have to be responsible and do what we need to do in order to be, you know, good citizens of the world and try to prevent the spread to people who can't, you know, are going to be potentially more impacted than you. And ultimately, yeah, it sucks, but and we'll be fine. We'll get through this, and then we'll have E3 next year, and then we can see the train wreck in real time then. So just think of it this way. They now have a year to extra train wreck it. Just think about it. Think about it. I do want to move on, and so if you have any more thoughts.
I don't know. Like, I went a few times to E3, and I'm definitely not doing that ever again. Just because, like, it's an out-of-pocket expense for me, right? And it's, well, for all of us, but it's when you come from Canada, it's especially expensive. So it's not something that I need anymore. Like, it used to be a cool idea to go to E3, but I've done it, so other people can go instead. And it kind of seems like maybe I went right before it started changing a little bit too much, and they started allowing, or maybe maybe because they allowed me to enter now, like maybe I'm the reason why anyone can go now. It's like, well, we let that guy in, like
we let Guillaume Vett in.
Yeah, seriously. So
who am I kidding? They wouldn't pronounce your name right. They would butcher it. It'd be terrible.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, so before going, I don't think. I never really bought into the E3 hype in the first place. I've never been a reading previews kind of person ever. So I
famed Nintendo podcaster Guillaume Vett hates video game coverage.
I don't hate video game coverage. I've always loved reading reviews, like actual hands-on impressions of games. Like, okay, and I can play this right now. Sweet. But previews have limited appeal to me. So
I've always been more enthusiastic about preview coverage, but especially in something like an E3 kind of context, it's just best to take it for what it's worth, you know, because you are talking about people seeing things under very particular circumstances.
The worst circumstances imaginable.
Yeah, you know, it's just like what you don't do is read something that might be like really warm and think, well, that's it now. I mean, I'll buy the limited edition for 50 grand and get unreasonably excited about it. you take it all for what it's worth, and you know, I always thought it was fun. I never did get to go. I don't think I would fare well in such a circumstance at all. But reading the coverage coming in, as it comes in, sort of especially for certain kinds of games that might not have been like as picked up on by the biggest outlets, but NWR and Planet GameCube and its previous incarnation was always very good at getting too early. Like that, those are some of the things that I'll remember, watching E3 from afar over all these years. Obviously, it kind of wanes a bit as it goes on because it just, especially with the kind of the rise of directs and all that, it's not been the sort of the one like big bomb of news and hype for a long time now. That is more of a nostalgia thing really than a current thing.
Doing news at NWR used to be like basically just updated release dates. Like, news didn't really happen until, like, the nuclear bomb went off. And then I was just like, oh, God, news. We've got 142 news stories to write. It's definitely more spread. I do think that the biggest losers here are going to be these smaller games, though. Because you mentioned it. Like, there is a section of E3 that is not open to the public. And there's a few of them. One of them is called Concourse Hall, which is a hall on the concourse. Shocking, I know. It's a ballroom. And they set up these cubicles, and that's what they are. They're basically like 8-foot tall cubicles that are essentially like suites. I mean, there's a door, they've got rooms inside them. There's demo units inside that may be showing two or three games. These are for smaller publishers who didn't pay for a booth spot. But Nintendo does a really good job showing off at least some indie games in their presentation. But a lot of other stuff ends up in this area. And so we would book appointments in there. So like I remember last time I went, we saw three or four games in 17-bit's booth, which was in this concourse hall. And these games aren't going to be able to get hands-on with the media in the same way. And that's unfortunate because there was a couple games that we covered that I think we did a good job putting out there into the world. And, you know, we produced video content and we got to talk to people making the game. Like, that's one of the biggest things about this is it's not just that we get to play a demo of the game and write our impressions and that we get to take some pictures standing next to an 8-foot-tall moblin made of plaster. It's that we get to talk to the person who's making the game right now as we're playing it and look at them and go, yo, why is it like that? Or, hey, can I do this? Or, you know, in questions that one of the things that's really tough to do is try to anticipate the questions that the audience is going to want answered and ask them. But being informed by having my hands on a controller and then being able to ask follow-ups to what I'm experiencing is something that can't just happen from demos. Like, you can't just put a demo on the system and it's like, okay, there you go, go play it. This is a unique experience that can only be had in the confines that are currently not advisable per current health standards. So it is what it is. And that's a loss that we're going to have to deal with. And we'll, you know, NWR, I'm sure, will do its best to make do with what we can do. And look, we're not on the A coverage tier. We don't get access to everything. E3 was kind of our democratizing chance to, just through sheer temerity and tenacity, get our hands on stuff that we might not normally get. So yeah, we'll just have to push through and deal with it. But, you know, it's a bummer. The whole thing sucks. And I would, you know, Guillaume is right. You've gone to E3. You've done it. You've climbed the mountain. And you're right. You're probably never going to go again. I'd also say I said that once. I've been to 4 E3 since then. I'm sure I said it after every last one. This is it. I'm not doing this shit again. And then I would go and I'd have a really good time and also be miserable. And then I would sit down and go like, huh, okay. I really hope that's not that we haven't had the last one accidentally and not known it. That would suck. That would really suck. If they were going to do one more and that would just call it, I'd want them to announce that shit before it started, because that shit would get wild. But it is what it is. You know, we'll still get our game news and announcements. And I do want to use this opportunity for a quick plug. J&J Dream Factory is going to save the gaming industry. If you are not already listening, or not already a patron of NWR, this coverage that we just talked about, this temerity and tenacity to get your hands on games that are hidden from the public view behind cubicle walls that you have to beg and plead and email 26,000 people to get access to because we're not a big site, that you have to go try to find not the Natsume contact so you can play whatever their friggin' Harvest Moon, we'll call it, shell of its former self is for the year. Or so you can play Dragon, what was it, Dragon Maid Cafe, that fucking weirdo game from Xseed. If you need that coverage in your life, if you want that coverage in your life, you might need help. But you can help us give it to you. If you want to see TYP get stabbed in the chest by the designer of, what was that fucking game called? That weird, like, rock and roll drum simulator game.
What, Rocksmith or something?
No,
or?
No. Mr. One Mirren Troops.
Mm. Oh, yeah, Metal Gals? Or
yeah, Gal Metal. Gal Metal. Yeah, if you want to see Tak Fuji stab TYP with a guitar, well, look, that costs money. That costs money to get that. Also, that really happened. E3's weird. You know, we have the site as expenses. You can contribute to that. And if you toss in, what is it, a couple bucks, I think?
Is it like a dollar a month or something?
It's a dollar. It's a dollar a month. You get access to the NWR Patreon.
I could be
Patreon.
Completely wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's right.
We'll go with a dollar. That is patreon.com/NWR. One of the features is an RFN podcast every month that we totally missed on last month. So we're trying to make up for it real quick. But we're going to make up with it. J&J Dream Factory is going to save E3. I don't know what that means. We're going to record it in like 20 minutes. We don't know what that means. We'll figure it out. And we have business acumen guests to join us to help us sort through our great ideas and our great ideas. Because, of course, all business is great ideas. So there's that to look forward to. But there's other business to talk about. More fun news. Much more fun news. Nintendo and LEGO have been teasing something for the last couple days. It involved a horrifying Mario face with like an LED board.
But yes, some, it's a dynamic face.
Yeah, with LED face and just like scrolling. It was haunting.
His eyes and his mouth can sort of change accordingly, sort of to expressions that I'm not quite sure I've ever seen any version of Mario make. Before.
That's one of the things that's really weird about that set. So before
we haven't announced what the news is yet. So
oh, sorry.
I was talking about the teaser they did for a couple days, and then today they actually announced it. Guillaume, why don't you describe it?
Okay. So before I muted the word Lego on my Twitter feed, I did see the kind of trailer, which is a set of Mario themed Lego blocks that seemed to be. Connected, you know, not
smart
augmented reality, but it seems like there are sensors in the minifigures and in the various some of the pieces that you can use, and so you're kind of creating this virtual obstacle course for Mario. Of course, it seems like the sensors are not on top of his head, but on his feet. So Mario now. Big news, he actually breaks blocks with his feet, or he gets coins from question mark blocks with his feet. So that's kind of weird. The thing I was going to say is that I don't understand why they seem to lean heavily. I'm not sure if it's part of the video that they made, or if it's part of the actual set, but there was like classic Super Mario Brothers 1 music playing. While the kids were shown playing with a set, and at some point, like you can hear even like the music accelerate, like you're running out of time. So I don't know if that's part of the game, but I found it kind of weird that they were fully leaning into the original 8-bit music for Super Mario Brothers, but then you've got these minifigures which look like shit. they look like nothing, no on-brand Mario that I've ever seen.
Or on-brand minifigure.
Yeah, like it's not even a cross of the two. It's not more one or the other. It's
They're
like
weird.
This, what if someone else decided that, what if someone thought like, oh, I've got this idea. Let's make these off-brand things that are actually licensed. You know, off-brand
right.
looking licensed things. I don't know. I thought it was kind of horrifying personally, but someone else take it from here.
So basically what it is it's like a board game, and the individual components of it, like the different challenges or whatever, and like enemies, like all these traps and shit, those are all sold separately, and there's all kinds of weird interactive elements, and Mario has like weird video components in his body and his face that can show things like coins popping up and stuff. So it's like a
Or you make it at the end of the course and it shows you the flag, because of course it makes total sense that Mario would have a flag on his like torso. What?
It's not that he's got a flag on his torso, it's that he's got a pinball machine sort of display in his torso.
Yes.
That's right.
it's a weird, like, low quality, but somehow also high quality screen, too. Like, pinball machine, but with color.
That's a good description, yeah.
It's very
weird. You couldn't run Doom on that thing, but I guess you could try.
Somebody's gonna try.
Oh, yeah.
It's really odd, but at the same time, like, one, it's going to cost $1 billion because it's Lego, And this is like the most expensive ass looking Lego shit I've ever
seen.
Yeah,
I guess you're going to have, what, like NFC chips built into these different components for the...
Presumably, yeah. And video components built into Mario. So like this thing ain't going to be cheap.
I you could glimpse some other sort of, well, I mean, you got better look at like Goombas, which look weird. Bowser Jr. was there, and you got a glimpse of Yoshi, but not the full look for me to be offended at how wrong it is.
never go the full Yoshi. Yeah, so the screens on Mario are in his chest. There's a square screen between his very cubic body, between his two pectorals. The eyes and the mouth.
Yeah.
So, like, there's going to be a degree of hauntingness here that I'm just not comfortable with. But yeah, it's like a... I don't understand the game. I really don't. Because, like, there's a timer on his chest. And yeah, it's weird. The whole thing is very strange. But at the same time, it's a much more interesting story for just its weirdness. Like, how weird this fucking thing is probably what makes it the most interesting story. Cause it is maximally strange. There was a press release that went out, and I don't have it in front of me because I'm a good host who's prepared. Let's see if I can pull that.
I've already deleted it. I'm so sorry.
I've gotten it multiple times. Did they actually mention any prices in this?
No, they don't.
Neither a video game nor a traditional Lego brick based set. Lego Super Mario. Lego registered Super Mario TM is a new product line that features interactive all caps Lego Mario figure who collects coins in real-life game levels created with, again, all caps Lego, bricks. The new line will let kids experience the playful world of Super Mario like never before. Super Mario will be brought to life in physical all caps Lego worlds with new level challenges and styles of play will be a part of the iconic all caps Lego experience enjoyed by generations. The video, which hints at what fans can expect when all-cap LEGO, not all-cap Super Mario, launches this year, shows a player using an interactive Mario figure to collect coins in a real-life game level that has been created with all-caps LEGO bricks. Quote, "We are very excited to bring Mario into the physical world through interactive and social all-caps LEGO," said Julia Golden, Chief Marketing Officer EVP of the all-caps LEGO group. With this experience, we will help millions of kids. Wait. With this experience, we will help millions of kids with... All right, how do you want to think she ends that completely insane sentence?
Well, you know, supposedly millions of people are going to go to Jurassic Park, but imagine how much that cost.
All right, well, so they're going to help millions of kids with dinosaurs. John, what do you got? How are you going to end with this experience we will help millions of kids with?
Let millions of kids build dickish Mario levels because there's never been an opportunity to do that before.
Yeah, real dickish Mario levels, like real ones.
All right,
the kids then have to run through.
You're right. You got all right, Guillaume. You got one.
We'll help millions of kids. The kind of the BS benefit of video games that always gets trotted out is like we'll help millions of kids improve their hand-eye coordination, right?
Nope. So this is help millions of kids with love for Mario to engage and play in a completely new way. It's
fucking engage. Bullshit.
Fucking bullshit ass sentence right there. I've always liked all caps Lego products and how they help children use their imagination to play, said Takashi Tezuka. I've never actually seen his first name written first. It's or his given name. Executive Officer and Game Producer of Nintendo Co. Limited. The new product we created together with the All Caps Lego Group seeks to combine two different styles of play. One where you freely build the world of Mario and the other where you play with Mario in a world that you have created. Lego registered Super Mario TM will launch later this year. More information made available in the future. I like that they got Tezuka for the interview, and that is that, like, having heard Tezuka talk dozens and dozens of times, many of them at E3, there is no way he said that. Look.
It's nice to see Tezuka actually in front of something Mario, because he's got a lot to do with Mario being, you know, the original game being what it was and the series being what it has become over the years and all
I
that.
But he did entirely,
because Miyamoto was just the face for the so face. Long that it kind of. I guess that it may well be a function of the fact that he's got all these other license related things that he's doing with the movie and the amusement park and everything else.
I agree. At the same time, there's no way Tezuka said that. 0%.
Someone in his office may have drafted it.
A PR person handed him a note that he was then asked to sign, as it was from him.
Aesthetically, which is all you've got at this point with these little teasers online, it doesn't... strike you as being desperately appealing, but at the same time, it's kind of nice that it's not just something super obvious, so like they actually tried to do something with it. Hopefully it will actually be fun for kids to actually play with. I didn't really do the Lego thing as a child, so I couldn't tell you, what's that appealing about it in general anyway. But the fact that it's actually trying to be different in the practical sense seems to be at least kind of a praiseworthy ambition. Now whether it actually delivers on that, and certainly delivers on that at a reasonable price, considering how expensive. Just its premium over other Lego stuff, because we've got a screen in there and all this other stuff. Like, whether it's really going to justify that is a whole other thing. But
this will be $1 million. There's a Shy Guy Lego. I saw that. Mario is apparently Bluetooth, because it's a Bluetooth logo on Mario's back, as is normal. There's a lot of stuff in, I've watched this video a few times since we started talking. There's a lot going on here. Charles Martinet can now say that he has spoken in a Lego figure, in case anybody's curious what other things he has left to add to his Lifetime Achievement Awards. I'm sure that was one that wasn't there before. Spoken voice of a Lego figure, but he's got it now. This is weird. I just kind of wanted to add it.
you could have a Super Mario Advance set, couldn't you? Where every single square is not just what I needed, for one of the four characters.
Even when the
Mario's little torso screen, the flames come up and he's burning to death or whatever, it's just what I needed.
Jesus,
he's had enough at that point. That's what I'm saying.
We all have. We all have. It's fine. John was right earlier. What can I say? I am personally trying to figure out how best to write my The Treason of Lego Mario article.
Is this like The Treason of Isengard?
Yes, it's exactly the same, because they got inside the Kinect's universe and learned how it worked, and then went to Lego to smash it to the ground.
Just how many forests of Fangorn had to die to give birth to this ghastly chimera.
Look, all I'm saying is that right now, I look at Lego and I say, they managed to convince Mario to dump their rivals in Kinects, and I just can't keep dealing with the constant oppression in my life that Denmark has been presenting. Just, aren't you tired? Aren't you tired of having to wake up and go, what does Denmark want from me today?
Well, I've been long sick of the Danes.
Just in general. No particular reason. He's just like, no, just fuck him. I just wanted to discuss the long-term plans of Mario Lego for some weird ass reason. So
I assume there'll be plenty of obvious stuff too. Sets of a Bowser Castle set or something, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the It's a weird game board looking thing. I don't know. We'll see pretty soon. It's interesting, but primarily weird, and that's why I wanted to put it on the show. All right, we're gonna go ahead and wrap the show up there. That was a little. We don't do news that often, but it kind of needed to be handled today. And ultimately, there were things that should be said. And so LEGO was kind of there to give us a softening, something dumb to talk about, which is great. We're gonna go ahead and call the show, though. You can send your emails and comments and music suggestions to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. John, how are you gonna butcher the email address this week?
It is let's see, radicalflexnonsense@nintendoworldreport.com.
Not wrong. That's radicalflexnonsense@nintendoworldreport.com. Just the first letter of each, please. RFN@NintendoWorldReport.com. Greg, I've asked
so
that
I actually have a plug.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry. Plugs, Guillaume.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, last night I recorded another Thirsty Mage episode. So the topic was Trails of in the Sky, the classic PSP RPG that might become suddenly relevant in some way to Nintendo gamers. So.
In a very weird way.
Yeah, well, the Trails of Cold Steel 3 is coming out next month on Switch, right? So
Nine games into the series.
Yeah, that's not ideal. But I guess in around 2011, I got into the habit of buying games on Sony platforms that I then didn't touch. So I went and played this game that I had bought way back when, and I think it's around 2011, and they've basically released one game a year in that series, and now that the XSEED has relinquished the rights to NISA, NIS America is actually putting some of Nihon Falcom's games on the Nintendo platforms, so
yep.
That's pretty cool.
They're responsible for Ease 8 and this.
Yep. So I'm for that. And for once, spoilers, but I actually really, really liked the game that I talked about on the Thirsty Mage. I kind of there was this unfortunate trend of me finally trying out a game that I was then disappointed by. Not the case here.
Excellent.
It was really, really good. So it's definitely making me more excited about Cold Steel 3 next month.
Cool. All right. Well, Greg.
Yep.
Play us out.
First of all, I'm aware it just recently was the 25th anniversary of Chrono Trigger's initial Japanese release, but we're not going with that. If anybody was expecting that. It's been mined a bit over the years. In fact, more in the years preceding the closing music era than during it, because John took like 5 years to play through it or whatever.
That's
so
true.
Kept having the excuse to like use it with used like, the Battle with Larvos theme and like all sorts of stuff. It's been mine. Not that I'm not saying we'll never use anything from it again, because the American anniversary will be coming up at the end of the year or whatever. But not this week, because this week is episode 664. You've got to do an N64 game, right? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So yeah. Which also
but
marks
664.
Which also marks 400 episodes since our N64 revenge episode. Which
Damn.
Itself was like, what, like 167 episodes after the thing that we were revengeancing or whatever. But
it's fine. Well, I mean, we got an immediate revenge with Radio Free Lords of Thunder. So that was the follow-up revenge.
Yeah. We tried to have it both ways on the cold serving. But, I thought it had to be an N64 game. It turns out, just coming up pretty shortly, I think, is the 20th anniversary of Kirby 64, the Crystal Shards, which the music here, we haven't used that many Kirby songs, actually,
in the hundreds of episodes now that we've done closeout music for. And I think Kirby 64's music is pretty notable for being one of the most faithful kind of in sound to its predecessors in the series. You know, because the N64 did not have a dedicated sound processor, and really, it was about as much, you know, how much of the overall processing power did you want to throw at the sound? You know, that was what it was, a huge kind of trade-off that you had to make if you actually wanted the music to sound good. This is what gave us mono sound in F-Zero X, because everything right. had to go to making it run at 60 frames a second. But with Kirby, it's really quite close to previous Kirby stuff and just previous HAL stuff. There's some of the soundtrack kind of reminds me of Hyperzone, which was an early HAL Super Nintendo game that was like a cross between F-Zero and Space Harrier. They really managed to kind of keep that Kirby sound alive on N64, even though, you know, they didn't have that Sony, you know, kind of music chip anymore to actually create it. So it's kind of quite a nice achievement in a way. And we've got a song here called Ripple Star that came back in Triple Deluxe, but it's this very kind of frenetic, somewhat jazzy, kind of bass driven song. A lot of fun. And I didn't play Kirby 64 when it was new. I came to it on Wii U Virtual Console. And I don't know whether it's one of the strongest entries in the series, but the music's strong and the mixing power-ups is cool, because what it ultimately culminates in is Kirby getting to wield a double lightsaber. I mean, yes. If that isn't everything you've ever wanted, then I guess we're just fundamentally dissimilar people.
It was a product of a moment. All right, well, on that, it's time for us to go. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
We don't have. Should I talk about Nier or
your call? What? Your call.
Oh my god.
I wouldn't mind hearing about it.
What do you got in your mouth, John?
Okay.
Eating some cereal.
Fair enough. No, that's great. Is it extra crunch, or are you keeping the crunch down? He's chewing. All right, that's great. Yeah, you could. Let's talk. Let's talk a little Papa Nier here.
Papa Nier.
So in Japan, there's two versions of this game, and the only real meaningful difference is one of them is the character is old, and in one of them, it's Gackt.
It's Gackt?
He's a model. He's a famous model in Japan.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So like, the difference is, do you want to play as old Nier, aka Papa Nier, or this pretty boy Nier? And then in the West, they only localized the old Nier. It's right. Very weird.
Yeah, it's just overall a weird game. So, Nier. Okay, so this is a very old game. It's like 10 years old. And as I said last week, I had a save file from 2011 on there. And I basically started this game and gave up after 2 or 3 hours because I don't even know where to start. Okay, so
what Nier is Nier?
Is a game by Yoko Taro.
Yes.
You might have guessed that the much more popular Nier Automata that came out on PlayStation 4 and PC, and I think Xbox One.
Yeah, it did come out later.
Yeah, so that's kind of a, not a direct sequel, but more like a spiritual successor, maybe. Although it might be more of a direct sequel than I think. I just, I don't know enough about the story.
There is a universe connection, yes.
Okay. So Nier is the game that came before that, and it's actually kind of an offshoot of Drakengard, another Yoko Taro game. And Drakengard is this weird RPG which had several different endings. And I believe that in one of them, I think it was like just this regular fantasy RPG setting, right?
But yeah,
in one of them, I think that you were sent in time or something, and like basically like the end of our civilization, our actual world, was one of the endings, and Nier kind of springs from that ending. So I guess the only reason one might be interested today to play this game would be if they really are interested in that lore and they want to explore Yoko Taro's oeuvre and they have to see everything. I'm just going to go ahead and say that it's not worth it and that you're better off watching a YouTube and, you know, reading wikis and things like that to see, like, to read about the connections between his games and maybe not bother to play with this one. Because this is a, I guess, an action RPG. And it does not feel great to play. You might see comments online if you read up on this game about can't remember the description that I've seen. Like, the main character jumps, like, I don't know, sick frog or something. Like, no one in the world jumps like that. It's a really weird animation. The combat, you mostly mash the buttons, and the enemies all look the same. They are called shades, and they're kind of these, like, not wispy looking. There's like this effect that was kind of popular during the PlayStation 3 era where, I don't know, they're kind of like half transparent. Like, there are these black and yellow creatures that don't look like much, just like imps and things like that. And they have a tendency to completely surround you, and your only chance is basically to mash the buttons before they kick you and send you flying really far in some direction. The game is frustrating to play because because they're just like these kind of undefined, shadowy creatures, it's hard to see when they're going to hit you. And so, like, all these tools that you have, like a parry move and things like that, are not very useful when you can't see all of the enemies that completely surround you. And also, they're hard to see in the first place. And, like, it's hard to distinguish them, and it's hard to see what they're doing, if they're about to hit you or not. And so the first time I played it, I gave up because the villager gave me a side mission, take this package and deliver it to this other place, and don't use your roll maneuver to, you know, your evasion maneuver, and don't get hit.
Just don't do it.
Yeah, don't do it. And so I make it to this this place where I'm supposed to deliver that package a bunch of times, but it's on a suspended bridge, like this kind of like rickety, you know, Temple of Doom kind of thing. And it's just full of monsters. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't make it safely through that. And eventually I was just like, you know what? This is absolutely the opposite of fun, and F this. So I just gave up. Now I played through it again. I made it past. I just needed to double jump a lot to make it past them. So I don't know, egg on my face, I guess. I could have been done with Nier a long time ago if I had figured that out.
I mean, you could still have been done with Nier a long time ago.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I guess I picked it up because I don't have a PlayStation 4. I am interested in Nier Automata. Nier Automata is developed by, of course,
Platinum.
Bayonetta Platinum? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Platinum, yeah.
Platinum, so it's a much better feeling action game from what I can understand.
Yeah, they were brought in because Yoko Taro was aware and hit his boss. So you left out one really important thing. Drakengard and all its fucking weird nonsense is a Square Enix property.
Sure.
Which is insane to think about.
Because it's so janky? Or what?
Because it's so janky, because it's so Yoko Taro-ish, because it's so, I mean, it's so weird and nonsensical.
I haven't played it, so. No, really, my interest was in playing Nier Automata, and also, but of course I bought this game before Nier Automata was a thing, so I guess, I don't have an excuse. I bought it because this game had its fans. Yoko Taro already had his fan club back then, and they would hype up this game, and there was also kind of a mild controversy where Joystick, the website, which is now Engadget, I believe, Joystick has folded. So one of the McElroys had given this game a kind of a failing review, a failing note, and because he couldn't make it past this compulsory fishing meeting game. And turns out that he misunderstood the what the game asked of him. Like, there was another, like, basically someone near a beach gives you a fishing rod, asks you to catch this fish, and but you're not supposed to catch it on this beach. You're supposed to catch it on a beach that's a little bit further away. But he didn't catch that, so kind of couldn't succeed at that mini game that was forced on him, and then like it kind of became this infamous thing. The game is often obtuse as to what it wants from you, so sometimes you struggle a bit because it's just the instructions aren't clear. And yeah, like the, so everything, you know, like the kind of the annoying mini games, the so-so combat, the controls that don't feel great, it all combines to the fact that like this game is not exactly an enjoyable experience. And the thing is, I think when I bought it, I knew this. Like, even Nier's fans, they didn't hide the fact that this game is not the best, but
do they view it as kind of an acquired taste?
No, I think that it's more like the narrative twists that it pulls kind of blew their minds so much that they could forgive a lot.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, as far, like, of course, I haven't played Nier Automata, but I think that Nier Automata pulls the same kind of stunts. Sometimes, like, literally, like, it's the same twist happen. It probably does it better, and also the game is more enjoyable in the first place. So, as far as I can tell, like, the Nier Automata is completely replaced Nier in the conversation. And for a good reason. Like, there's basically the sequel erased the original. There's no reason to go back to the first one. Mm-hmm. And so, unless you don't have a PlayStation 4, like me. So I just went back, played this game, and it just made me realize, like, you know what? Games sometimes have a shelf life.
Yeah.
They don't stay good forever. And there's kind of like, if you miss the window where it might be, they might be relevant, or they might be in any way enjoyable, then you should just not bother to go back to them. But it does, I don't know, like it did some neat things, you know, but it's all I can do is basically list the things that everyone else lists when they talk about Nier and talk about the stuff that it did that was neat. Like, there's a whole thing where you're playing an action RPG, right? But then the game becomes a visual novel for this one section, this one part of the story. And that's like, oh, okay, I did not expect that. That's weird. That's novel. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I could talk about, like, the music is kind of good, although there's like these there's like these vocals to the music and the overworld, and the overworld is kind of, it's not a huge sprawling thing, it's more like Ocarina of Time's Hyrule, you know. It's kind of more of a hub to get to different places, but you end up traversing it often, and there's like this these vocals, there's this woman singing, and it's very repetitive, and it's beautiful, but it's like it's so repetitive, and it's all you hear if you have the game playing at a low volume on your TV. So eventually it was driving me nuts, so I went into the options and I had to turn it off because I was just like, I can't hear this anymore.
Yeah.
And then
I mean really, like, you never do that with a game. Like, a game never has any kind of audio or music that is annoying that you actually disable it. But yeah, I've come across a couple games like that, but that's it.
Yeah, it's a poorly chosen track for an overworld. And then you make it to this other area that's like a second village in this game's world, and there's even more vocals, and they're so overpowering. Like, they're the second place that you basically visit in this game. So it kind of gave me the impression that, like, oh, this soundtrack is going to get so on my nerves. But yeah, like, it's basically if you had like Carmina Burana playing in a loop, in like Kakariko Village on Zelda, like, you know, like, it's just like, it's too much. Jesus Christ. Please, tone it down.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the tracks, like, eventually I turned the music back up, and, it was fine. It was just those two, that were like, I don't know, gave me a bad impression.
Yeah. Just obnoxious.
Yeah. I guess the one reason I stuck with it so much, despite not really enjoying the controls and the getting tired of the gameplay pretty quickly, is that the characters are really well written and really fun, and they're not characters that I've seen in a whole lot of Japanese RPGs or even American games. Like, they're written in a way that makes them really fun to just listen to. They're all voice acted. The voice acting is really good. There's like, and so your main character is kind of your slab of meat who just wants to kill monsters. He's not particularly interesting. He's really ugly. He looks like Donovan in the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, like mid getting old, turning to dust. Like, he's really ugly. So there's that. There's Weiss, which is a floating magical tome, which is very kind of, like Rye's sense of humor. He allows you to cast magic spells, basically. And he, I don't know, like, the voice actor voicing him is doing his best, Alan Rickman impression. And he's just like really fun. Like, he just takes the piss out of you all the time. And there's also this, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but she's you know, this like lady badass, which could be you know, it's been done before, but she's so blunt in what she says, and she's got such a potty mouth. She's really fun to listen to, and it's kind of funny because every time that you start the game, before you can even like get through, like press start to get to the, you know, choose your save file, the introduction starts playing automatically, and the first thing you hear is her saying like, "Weiss, you dumbass," and I don't know, it's kind of a weird, in a weird way, it kind of sets the tone for the rest of your play every time.
That's, Kane or Kane?
Oh, Kane? Yeah, Kane. Yeah,
Kane. Yeah.
And also, one more thing I should say about her is that she's just wearing lingerie. Like, I know that Yoko Taro has gone on record in interviews as saying that he puts sexy women in his games because he likes to look at sexy women. So I appreciate the lack of bullshit here, but, you know, she's got lace that, like, in the back, like, that actually doesn't hide her butt crack. Like, it's half lingerie and half, like, a hospital gown. It's really weird. Her breasts are, like, just, like, in these little, neat little kind of tied up pockets. I'm glad that Karen didn't really, like, happen to be in the room too often when I was playing through this game, because sometimes I was just like, holy shit, what is this? And I would have been a little bit embarrassed if she had seen, if she had gotten a good look at Kaine.
Yeah, she's out there, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't know. Like, it was an interesting experience to go back and play this, but ultimately my takeaway is that I shouldn't have done that. So,
I regret this, everything.
Yeah, basically. So may this serve as a warning. I just, last night I recorded the Thirsty Mage episode with David Lloyd, who just played through Nier Automata, and he was interested in playing the original Nier because of that. And I told him, well, I could sell you this copy for less than eBay because I want to get rid of it. But then last night I said, like, are you sure you want it? I'm going to tell you right now, it's not worth it. And so, yeah, he passed. I don't recommend this game. Everything that it does, I think that probably Nier Automata did better. So.
Well, that was a, you know, I give you a ton of credit for actually getting through Nier. Cause I saw, like, you know the shit I can put up with, and I saw the shit that game does and said nope.
Well, actually, maybe I didn't put up with all of it. One of the things that the game does is that it asks you to play through it like 4 times.
Oh yeah,
or at least like the second half of the game, like it has you play through it a bunch of times. And as soon as I saw what it did the second time, I realized that it was definitely not worth it. I don't know if I want to get
into it. Yeah, there's it has lots of branching alternate paths that require multiple playthroughs.
Right. And it's ultimately not worth it. I saw what I liked about the writing of the dialogue and everything. I like the way that the characters speak and the humor there and all of that stuff, but the actual story of Nier is surprisingly weak. It doesn't really pass muster today. And some of the narrative stuff that I talked about is, and it's kind of signposted really early, like it's foreshadowed that the enemies that you keep killing are actually, you know, like maybe you're wrong to do that. Maybe they have an inner life and maybe they've got their own stuff going on. So like, you know, it's this whole, so just like Spec Ops The Line, like it kind of tries to do the whole thing about like, maybe you've been the bad guy all this time, except that in this case, it doesn't really work because the enemies are very aggressive and there's never a point where they're not aggressive. And there's never a point where you have to be the aggressor first before they attack you. So it doesn't really work. Like they try to, and it's the most like ham-fisted stuff ever. Like, okay, like the second time that you play through a game, like the first boss is, turns out that he's really trying to defend his friends and like, stop attacking my friends. Like suddenly you can hear what they're saying. And it's the as I said, like it's very ham-fisted. It's not great. So
no, it is what it is.